Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting of the Water Division to order. We do have a quorum present. The first item of business is approval of the minutes, and I understand Representative Morrison has reviewed them. Would you like to make a motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I make a motion to approve the minutes.
Representative Morrison moves approval of the minutes for January 14th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all of those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion passes. We are going to be continuing our overview of different water management by state agencies, and the first agency that we're going to be having up today is the Public Facilities Authority. Mr. Freeman, if you could come up, introduce yourself, and start with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. I think you have a handout in your packet that with start with kind of a overview of the PFA. We're a little different than most state agencies. We are actually a multi-agency financing authority. We're governed by a board of six state commissioners. We administer a variety of programs in conjunction with those member agencies. And essentially what the PFA is a infrastructure bank. We manage the investments and transactions for several large revolving loan funds. Also then administer loan and grant programs in conjunction with our member agencies, and specifically it's the Pollution Control Agency for wastewater and some stormwater treatment projects, and then the Health Department for drinking water infrastructure projects. Those agencies prepare project priority lists. They do technical and engineering reviews. PFA staff does the financial side. We conduct credit reviews, set loans terms and conditions, service those loans, coordinate with other funding sources, and provide information about the sort of technical assistance on the financing side. The projects we're talking about are all types of the basic water infrastructure systems and the components thereof, wastewater treatment plants, drinking water treatment plants, all of the underground sanitary sewer collection systems, the water mains, distribution systems, wells, water towers, all of that. The PCA and Health Department prepare project priority lists on an annual basis. They're generally lists of projects that cities are seeking funding for over the next 5 years. They rank projects based on age and condition of the existing infrastructure, as well as public health and water quality environmental factors. Our largest programs are the Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Loan Funds, which combine annual federal capitalization grants and a state match that's provided, a 20% state match, with the loan repayments all revolved back into the funds. PFA also has the authority to sell tax-exempt revenue bonds to leverage those funds. And so we have authority to sell up to $2 billion in tax-exempt revenue bonds. Our bonds are rated AAA by all three rating agencies. They're totally supported and repaid by the loan repayments and investment earnings. There's no state backing to PFA revenue bonds. And so because of these revolving loan funds, as I said, we operate as an infrastructure bank and currently with about $2.3 billion in assets. PFA has also allocated within our Clean Water Revolving Fund about $90 million to non-point source loan programs administered by the Department of Agriculture and Pollution Control Agency. And those funds then revolve. The agencies administer those, and to date have generated about $266 million in loans to rural landowners. PFA receives no general fund money for program administration. All of our admin revenue comes from project financing fees. And then we also provide money to PCA and Health Department for their staff responsibilities in running the programs. The second page of the handout then lists the water infrastructure financing programs, starting with the Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Funds that I described. Currently, those because of the revolving nature of those funds, the lending capacity, average lending capacity of the Clean Water Fund is about $95 million per year. The Drinking Water Fund is about $40 million per year. And then those funds continue to grow with additional federal and state deposits and the revolving repayments that come back. Because these loans are made at below market interest rates, there's an interest savings to the cities and their taxpayers and ratepayers. In total, from all of our loans starting in 1990, total savings generated to local governments from the loans total about $880 million. There's a process in each year. We prepare an intended use plan of cities that are starting to seeking funding for a project that they hope will go to construction in that fiscal year. A lot of times getting on that intended use plan is the first step, and in many cases cities need some additional grant funds to offset some of that debt, and so the intended use plan ends up being quite a large list to start with, and a smaller list as we go through the year and cities actually are able to bring their projects to construction. We don't award funding until the construction is ready to start. The main program for helping to address affordability needs is the water infrastructure funding program, or the WIF grant program. Provides supplemental grants up to $5 million based on affordability criteria for high-cost projects. Those grants are either used to match with our own PFA loans, or we can do co-funding with USDA Rural Development, the federal agency that provides loans and grants to small rural communities. The next program is the Point Source Implementation Grant Program. PSIG is the grants that, or provides grants for, to help cities upgrade treatment facilities to reduce the discharge of specific pollutants to meet regulatory requirements. Phosphorus is the most common. There are others as well. Those grants can be up to $7 million, 80% of the eligible costs. And then there is also a much smaller, small community wastewater program that's specifically focused on small unsewered areas and helping them address problems from failing septic systems with small community subsurface drain fields and mound systems, things like that. I then included in your handout a copy of the list of awards from our 2018 annual report. So this list shows all of the cities and projects that we funded in fiscal year 2018, and then it shows the programs across the columns, and it shows in many cases how the programs are coordinated together to provide funding for the eligible projects. And with that, in total, in 2018, we awarded about $196 million in grants and loans to, I believe it is, 50 separate projects. Chair Hall, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Particular questions that people might have, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Freeman, welcome to committee, and thanks for the good work that PFA has done for many years here in the state of Minnesota, facilitating the infrastructure work that goes on. First, how do you calculate the interest rates you charge on your loans?
Mr. Freeman?
The interest rates are set, the basic framework is in our rules. We provide a discount from a market rate, and we use a AAA market scale as the starting point, and then provide, and then each year with that intended use plan process, the board adopts a specific base discount, which for many years has been 1.5% below AAA market, and then there are some additional discounts available for smaller communities. We have a 1% minimum on our average rate. Last year was about 1.1%. Market has been so low that our interest rates are pushed down to that at or very near that 1% minimum. But that's the process.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, are those rates then locked in for the life of the loan, or do they fluctuate during the
Mr. Freeman?
Fixed at the time of loan award.
Thank you.
And then Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then on a little different perspective, I'm sure you're aware there's been quite a discussion regarding LCCMR and the funds that LCCMR has been trying to utilize to do some bonding for water infrastructure projects. Taking that from a little different approach, if the LCCMR committee, and with the approval of the legislature and the governor, decided to make loans out of the corpus of LCCMR, is that something that PFA could manage?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, could manage, yes, but I would not, I don't think it would be the most efficient way of providing financing. The idea of loans from, I know that's written into the LCCMR statute in some ways. It was really done before these revolving loan funds were fully up and running. And I think the way the Clean Water and Drinking Water revolving funds are established with the federal dollars and the state match, I think it's a much more kind of robust and efficient way of providing loan funding to communities. So that would be my answer to that, is we could do it, but I'm not sure it would be the best policy.
Representative Torkelson.
Just a final question, and thank
sure.
you, Mr. Chair. Mr. You're Freeman, welcome. Do you have all the resources you need to meet all the needs that are out there, or could you use some more money?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the limiting factor really, for the most part, is the grant funding. The loans, we can ramp up available loan funds to some extent. We've got a lot of flexibility there with the sale of PFA revenue bonds. We can't fund all of the projects on the priority list, but generally we can make loans available to the top three quarters of projects on the priority list. But the issue becomes, for many of those cities, they've got to have some kind of grant funding to offset some of the debt. They just can't afford to borrow the full cost of the project. And so it's the grant side that tends to be the limiting factor in how many projects we can do.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. My question is builds a little bit off of Representative Torkelson's, is currently you had mentioned that there's a percentage of the projects that aren't able to get funding because of the limits on grants. How much would the grants need to be increased per year to be able to meet the demand and shovel-ready projects that are out there? Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific number right at the top of my head. A few years ago, when Governor Dayton put together a major water infrastructure initiative, and we looked at how much would be needed, and of course it's a need over a long period of time. It's not something that's the infrastructure needs that people have probably are familiar with, like $7 billion over 20 years. Those are long-term needs, require some long-term funding. The structure of WIF grants and PSIG grants and all of that together it's sort of a balance between the grants and loans. So I don't have a number to give you right now, but the governor's infrastructure package, I think, ended up with matching loan funds and grant funds. I believe it was $162 million initially proposed in the 2016 biennium, the majority of that into grants. So that number, as time goes on, we'll have a better idea of those numbers. We are working on with an estimated funding needs report that we're required to do by February 1st, which this Friday. So we'll have a public report that'll have a better picture of grant needs in the short term, and in the immediate next year or two, and that would be the basis, I guess, for putting together a bigger picture funding need.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. And then real quickly, I understand the legislative auditor did a review of the wastewater programs and came out with this report. Were you familiar with what percentage for the wastewater needs were going to be funded over the next 20 years? It sounded like I just glanced through it that there was going to be a shortfall. Do you have a little information on that you can just kind of tell us, over the next 20 years what they were looking at?
I don't have the report right in front of me.
No, and I apologize for that.
As I recall, their projection was that on the wastewater, the clean water side, if the current funding trends were to continue for both the loan programs and the grant programs, and keep in mind that the last few years of grant funding has been significantly more than it was, but if we're to continue at those trends, I believe they said about 66% or something of the needs, and then they went on to say that because for a lot of cities, I mean, there are cities that are still financing these needs on their own as well for various reasons. They have a project that they decide to fund themselves rather than come to PFA, and all of that is included in those big picture needs. And I think they estimated that if of the cities likely or the projects likely to seek state funding, PFA funding would be able to provide about 80%, I apologize, mm-hmm. I don't have the exact number, but let's say about 80% of the needs if the current funding trends were to continue. And that includes both the state level as well as the federal dollars that go into the revolving loan funds.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Freeman. I appreciate the information. We will then move on to our next presenter from the Metropolitan Council. If we could have folks come up and introduce themselves, and we can get underway. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and start.
Okay. I'm Lisa Thompson. I'm the General Manager of Environmental Services, and I'm happy to be here today to tell you a little bit about what we do. I also want to add to that, I know you were hearing from the other water agencies last meeting that you had, and I want to point out that we're part of the Minnesota water management framework. So we're not a state agency, but we do work closely with those water agencies. Environmental Services is has three primary roles, and we are an operating division of the Metropolitan Council. Our mission is to provide wastewater services and integrated planning to ensure that we're going to have sustainable water quality and water supply for the region. So that amounts to basically treating the wastewater and serving the municipal and industrial customers that operate and live within the region. But we also provide planning and technical assistance to those communities so that they can make good plans for their own communities. The color-shaded areas on this map show the areas that we serve with our eight wastewater treatment facilities. The green area, which is the largest, is served by the Metro Plant, which is the oldest treatment plant on the Mississippi River, and it's also our largest, of course. We manage $7 billion in assets that we've built over the many years of our existence. We spend about $150 million per year making sure that that infrastructure remains viable. We have eight wastewater treatment plants, and we operate our facilities with 600 employees. Given the time we have today, I have to apologize. I have a regular busy slide, but it kind of shows a little bit of the history. We originally came about when Minneapolis and St. Paul decided to build the Metro Plant back in the early 1900s. Excuse me, coming off a head cold here. And so the, in 1938, the Metro Plant started operating. And that started to clean up the water pollution that had been occurring when they built the lock and dam system, and they had been discharging wastewater directly to the river. So that top picture shows swirly stuff in the water. It actually literally was floating mats of sewage and bubbling gas from decomposition of that. So it was really unsafe for the public, and it was not good for the aquatic life. So in that time frame, the Department of Health had declared it a nuisance. DNR had done a fish survey and only found three fish between our regional area and down to Red Wing. So it was pretty critical that something get done. So they built the Metro Plant, and what we learned as a result of doing that is the environment was getting better, but it wasn't getting good enough. So there's been a lot of improvements that have been made through the years, especially in 1966 when it was upgraded to secondary treatment. I think a good thing for us to appreciate as Minnesotans who love our water resources, even before the Clean Water Act in 1972, we were being proactive to take care of our environment. There are several other things that we've done since then, and I actually think that there's three chapters that really stand out in terms of the success of our organization in the region and who we are today. And that one is the regional wastewater treatment system that was created in 1969. At that point in time, there was about 35 different treatment facilities throughout the region. There was a lot of struggles with maintaining them and operating and having enough financial resources. So with the support of communities, the legislature decided to regionalize the wastewater treatment system. And so on top of that, it gave us the ability to make sure that improvements were made. We consolidated down to much fewer facilities. And the other notable thing is in 1985, the region made a decision to invest in separating the stormwater and the wastewater sewers, which not only was a really good thing for the environment, today we treat 100% of the wastewater, and if you visit places across the nation where they still have combined sewers, anytime there's a large rain event, a lot of that wastewater goes into their lakes and streams. So it's been really good for the environment, but it's also been a good financial outcome because the places that haven't done that separation are finding themselves unaffordably able to address it today, and they're building large storage containment areas, and we don't have that issue to deal with. Just a quick snapshot of how we live within the region or how we exist within the region. Important here to note is that we don't do wastewater treatment alone. the communities are our partners. So this picture illustrates that there's pipes that lead from the home to the city's pipes, and then the city's pipes connect to our pipes. So it's really an entire system with lots of pipes in it. In fact, there's 7,500 miles of privately owned service laterals that connect homes. And there's a challenge with that because some of those pipes have developed leaks or they're not in very good condition, and that allows stormwater to get into the wastewater system. There's 5,000 miles of community-owned sewers, and then we have 610 miles where we're transporting it from the communities to our plants. We can't emphasize enough that the communities are our customers and they are our partners. If they didn't do their jobs well, then the system wouldn't work well. So we really rely on that partnership to be able to do a good wastewater treatment process. I mentioned that with all those pipes, this chance of pipes being leaky is a real thing for us to deal with. So in 2007, we realized that we were seeing big flow increases with storms. And if we didn't do something to address it, it would mean we'd have to enlarge our pipes and we'd have to enlarge our facilities, and we'd basically be treating water that didn't need to be treated. So the program working with the communities was to do what we call inflow and infiltration mitigation program. And that's had, you know, over a decade now of impact, and we're seeing that it is making a difference. So while the region's population has increased 9%, which we'd have more flow you would expect into the wastewater system. The precipitation is up, so where there's leaky pipes, more of that would be getting into those pipes and increasing our flow. But the flow has actually gone down. We know some of that is from water conservation, but we can also look at our data related to storm events, and we know that the INI mitigation program is having the effect we hoped, which would be to reduce the flows during storm. We are a wholesale provider of wastewater services, and so this graph shows where our revenue comes from. We have two types of revenue primarily. 77% of that comes from the use charge each year called the municipal wastewater charge, and that's based on the flow. So our current cost of service is about $123 per 1,000 gallons. 15% of our revenue comes from the sewer availability charge, or SAC, and that's a one-time charge for connecting up to the system. So as a new user, it's to pay for the capacity that was built in for growth. So it keeps the current users from paying for future users. We have $7 billion worth of capital infrastructure to maintain. We need to do this to ensure that we'll have a performance of the wastewater system, but also to make sure we're ready for the economic growth and development that calls for more flow to be treated. And we also make improvements within our facilities to make sure that we're continuing to do the right things to protect the environment and to make our system more efficient. In the area of water resources planning, our role is chiefly to help shed light on things that will affect how we grow. So in the water supply arena, we have been charged with producing a water supply plan. We do that in conjunction with local communities as well as the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Committee that's legislatively enacted and a technical advisory committee. And we learn from them what their issues and emerging issues are, and we gather technical data and information and try and get a whole picture kind of a view of what's going on. And to that point, it's so important to understand locally what's the situation that's drawing concern or needs to be addressed. So we've been working in a very collaborative way to support the regional sub-regional work groups so that they can look closely at what's affecting them, and we feel we can come up with a better cohesive overall regional plan if we support them locally in their sub-regional areas. With that, That's the Metro plant as it stands today, much bigger than when it was built and operated in 1938 and cost only $16 million at that time to build.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Any questions? Representative Tarkleton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Thompson, for being with us today. You've described a lot about the Metropolitan Council's role in wastewater treatment and the ancillary issue of inflow and infiltration. What I'm curious is, does the Metropolitan Council have an active role in stormwater facilities or treatment or anything along those lines?
So we
Ms. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do not do any stormwater operational piece, so all of our operational activities are around wastewater. But on the planning side, we provide technical support and assistance both on the water supply but also on water resources. So we have a pretty extensive understanding of what's going on in our receiving waters because that's important for us as an operator discharging wastewater, treated wastewater to a river, that we know what kind of an impact we're having or what other kinds of changes are going on. So we have a lot of good technical information about the quality of the environmental water that we discharge to. So we work with watersheds, and part of that is sharing information that we have about how we monitor our receiving waters. And we share information and technology and try and support them in any way that we can.
Representative Tarkleton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But along those same lines, Ms. Thompson, talk a lot about inflow, you know, clean water getting into the wastewater system. Do you have any idea how much wastewater is leaking out of the system and not being treated?
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. I do have a couple technical staff here. I'm not sure how we would wrap our arms around that, but you know, if you look at what's coming in, there's pressure when there's high groundwater. It's a little unknown to us how much might be leaking out, but the potential is that there could be some of that. And that's another important reason why the I&I program is a good thing to be doing.
Okay. Hearing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Thompson, for your presentation. And next we will be having a presentation from the University of Minnesota. We have two. First person coming up will be Dr. William Arnold. Mr. Arnold, if you'd like to introduce yourself and start with your presentation, that'd be great.
So I'm Bill Arnold, and I'm a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental and Geoengineering at the University of Minnesota. I've been there for about almost 20 years at this point. And I'll start this off by saying what I present represents my opinion, not those of my employer. Okay, let's start this up here. So I was asked to speak about current and emerging water issues in Minnesota. And given that this is a pretty broad topic, I went to the default strategy these days and crowdsourced my answers to the question. And so I talked to some of my colleagues in my department, University of Minnesota, as well as Brandy Toner in Soil, Water, and Climate, and then colleagues at the Institute on the Environment and in the Humphrey School as well, because water is occurring throughout the University of Minnesota, and we have various expertise, and I couldn't handle all of this without a little bit of help. So if we look at the really big picture, what's going to drive our issues with water in Minnesota are how much water we have and what quality it is. And we're lucky in Minnesota to have lots of water. The quality varies depending on what it's used for and how it's processed and what it flows through. But as population grows and as we change land use, and land use is going to change because we continue to expand the metro areas, turn farmland into exurbs or suburbs, we turn suburbs into more urban lands, we change which crops we grow, we take land out of agricultural production, all this will change how the water is used, and that will change how much water is available and the quality of that water. Those two things in turn will affect the infrastructure we need in order to treat the water or gather more water. And then the treatment needs are going to depend on the water quality. Right? If we change what's in the water, we might have to change how we're treating it. And of course, what's in the water will also affect environmental health. Overarching all of this as well is climate change. which will change the amount of water. We just saw that rain has increased over the past 20 years in Minnesota, and will also change the quality of the water. And all of this, you want the public to have trust that the water that's coming into their tap is safe to drink, and that the water that's leaving their house is being treated before it goes out into the environment. So as part of, there was the 25 by 25 town hall, one of Governor Dayton's initiatives. This is some data that Bonnie Keeler analyzed from those town halls, looking at what different regions of the states their concerns were relative to the average level of concern in the state. So up in the northeastern part of Minnesota here, people said contaminants of emerging concern was their greatest concern more often than in other parts of the state. In the metro area, it was road salt. Right? And if you notice a theme about a lot of these is it tends to be these concerns were chemically based. Right? They were contaminants, nitrogen, phosphorus, road salt, and sediment. So people seem to have a grasp around those issues, but microbiological issues also have a major role in the quality of our water and the issues we face. And that includes both viruses and bacteria. And so what I'd like to do is kind of go through this in types of water, and then also I'll drill into down into some specific types of contaminants as well, and then bring it back out into kind of a larger perspective on all of this. So some of the drinking water issues that we see as engineers, one of them is nitrosamines, which is a scary chemical term. They are carcinogens that are potentially formed during specific disinfection conditions of drinking water or wastewater. And usually this involves using chloramines for your disinfection rather than chlorine, and drinking water facilities have switched over to using chloramines because you generally get lower levels of disinfection byproducts. The issue is with chloramine, you get higher levels of nitrosamines. And you need specific precursors present for nitrosamines to form, and often those precursors come from wastewater. And so this winds up being an issue if you're doing wastewater reuse, either direct, so you're taking water from a wastewater treatment plant and trying to turn it into drinking water, or indirect, where we always put our wastewater back in the river and how far downstream the drinking water input is. There can be other sources of nitrosamine precursors as well. Animal manure might be one as well, specific chemicals. So if you take Zantac, for example, it's a fantastic nitrosamine precursor. I don't take Zantac. Also, contaminants of emerging concern in general. It's perfluorochemicals, and I'll talk more about perfluorochemicals in detail later on in the presentation. Pharmaceuticals, which, of course, we're all taking and excreting. And then, for example, various pesticides and insecticides. So the example I've given here is neonicotinoids. And the reason for that is that there's some recent work from the University of Iowa that has shown evidence, at least in Iowa City, which is surrounded by agricultural lands and there's lots of neonicotinoid usage, they can see neonicotinoids in their drinking water. There are opportunistic pathogens, so for example, Legionella. And this might not be things that are actually getting into the drinking water system, but things that are growing within the drinking water system, depending on how it's treated. What's there? Not that we're doing anything badly, but those are possibilities that are there. And then as we start to upgrade our treatment systems or repair pipes, so here are some drinking water pipes that are clearly corroded. You can have release of corrosion products from those pipes, which can be problematic, or you can go and you can start to recoat those pipes with new plastic or something like that. If you do that, what kind of monomers or curing agents get released out into the drinking water system as you upgrade your pipes? So there are various solutions here. We might need to upgrade our treatment, think about infrastructure replacement or alterations. In terms of wastewater, we just heard from our colleagues at the Mass Council, we do a fantastic job of wastewater treatment, right? But there's lots of value in that wastewater that we're not taking advantage of. We spend a lot of money taking the carbon in there and turning it into carbon dioxide and putting it in the atmosphere, lots of money for the nitrogen that's in there and putting it into nitrogen gas in the atmosphere. That takes energy and it takes money. We need to start thinking about whether or not we can use these wastes as a resource. There are people trying to say, can we turn this carbon that's in wastewater into fuel as a source of biofuel? So how do we actually extract energy out of wastewater? That carbon has energy. How do we recover the resources better? How do we make sure we're protecting from contaminants of emerging concern, either things that get back into the drinking water system or into the environment? Again, the wastewater treatment plants, this wasn't their task. They're not necessarily regulated on this. It's a concern that comes out from environmental impacts and the like. There are other interesting things you can do with wastewater that raise concerns potentially. If you gave me some sewage, I can tell you exactly what chemicals they're using in their house, right? There's legal issues there, there's privacy issues there, there's law enforcement issues there. But we can find out what's being used. The mass spectrometry and the analytical chemistry is good enough to do that now. And again, this is a field where innovation can really be used. But, you know, we have to make sure we're treating things correctly. Our wastewater treatment plants aren't doing anything wrong. But we need to be forward-thinking about what we might do next. And the risk there is it's hard to do that, right? Because what you try might not work, and then you're violating your permits, and then you get fined. And so there's issues there. Stormwater, which was mentioned previously here, is an interesting case. Because, again, there's a wide variety of chemicals that wind up in our stormwater. Because we use pesticides, we use herbicides, our pets go to the bathroom outside, so pharmaceuticals wind up in stormwater. There's also microbial risks, right? So if we start reusing our stormwater as for irrigation or to water lawns, you aerosolize it, and what microbial pathogens are potentially in our stormwater? I saw a talk recently about tire wear particles in stormwater, and this group was looking at toxicity to salmon on the West Coast. They found that specific species of salmon, if you expose them to tire wear particles, they all died, right? We don't know what kind of fish in Minnesota would have the same kind of susceptibility, and it turns out like one kind of salmon was really susceptible and another kind was not, right? So it was very subspecies specific. We've heard lots about chloride. Here the questions become, do some of the risks that chloride poses in the environment outweigh the benefits of some of the use from road salt? And obviously we're not going to stop using road salt, but can we do it more effectively? Are there alternatives? I have a water softener in my house that takes salt. That pits the salt into the chloride into the wastewater treatment plant, and now the wastewater treatment plant has to deal with it. And the problem with chloride is, if you ask me now, I can give you one way to remove it. It is really, really expensive. We also have old pollutants that where we haven't necessarily solved the problem. So nitrate comes from various sources. We have phosphorus. When I first moved to Minnesota, phosphorus was banned from lawn fertilizers in the metro. That said, that phosphorus that was put in there over many years is still in those lakes, right? So we have these internal loadings of phosphorus that still lead to algal blooms. And as we get this combination of nutrients and chemicals and climate change, potentially pesticides, the green algae that we see has an aesthetic problem. But as we've seen in other parts of the country, you have harmful algal blooms where the algae grow and then they make toxins. And there's a wide variety of chemicals there that could be of concern. And as climate continues to warm, we're more likely to get harmful algal blooms. If we drill down a little bit and look at specific chemicals, so this is the fluorinated chemicals. And the top one here is perfluorooctanoic acid. So this was the precursor used in Teflon. There are hundreds and hundreds of different perfluorochemicals. And I know the state just made a large settlement with 3M to deal with issues in the East Metro. I will hypothesize there will be other issues with perfluorochemicals around the state and other places. So any place that's done fire training activities in an airport, for example, that's a perfluorochemical. It wasn't properly contained, it will be in the groundwater. Colorado is dealing with this issue in a massive way right now. The other issue, the second structure that's shown here is not a perfluorochemical, it's a polyfluorinated chemical. But if you put this into the environment, it degrades into a perfluorinated chemical. And there are hundreds of these polyfluorinated chemicals that are used in flame retardants and other, not flame retardants, aqueous film-forming foams and other kind of products. The other thing, two chemicals I've shown here, one of the, these are both pharmaceuticals. So one of, well, one is pharmaceutical, but one on the let's see, can you see my, no, you can't see. The one on your left is Prozac. That's a fluorinated chemical. The one on the right is fipronil. So if you have a dog and you put spot flea treatment on it, that's what you put on your dog. And then you pat the dog, wash your hands, and it goes down the wastewater treatment plant, not the environment. And so there are something like 25% of all pharmaceuticals and pesticides coming onto the market now have fluorine in them. And we don't understand very well what happens to fluorinated chemicals when they break down, go into the environment, because there aren't very many natural chemicals that have carbon fluorine bonds in them. And so this is an issue that's going to take some work. The other thing is there are always new pollutants coming to market. This is great for someone like me because it keeps me in business, right? But we're constantly introducing new pesticides, pharmaceuticals, consumer products, nanomaterials. So silver was impregnated all sorts of clothing recently. Carbon nanotubes are starting to be put in products. All those things are going to go out into the environment. Something we use every day, plastics, and plastics make modern life possible. But as we wear them down like tires, right, we get small particles. We've banned, you know, microplastics and soaps and things like that. There's always polymers that are breaking down and coming into the environment. Some of that's accidental. Some of it's purposeful introduction. But we can't just think of the polymers, but the monomers and the particles, and these have opportunities to get into fish, into wildlife, and actually transport other chemicals along with them. That said, these same materials are going to probably be solutions to a lot of our environmental problems, so we don't want to look at nanomaterials as only being bad, but as also being a positive. If we look at groundwater, and I think Dr. Alexander is going to talk about this in much more detail than I am, source and wellhead protection is important. So if the water is infiltrating to the ground, there's contamination there, whether that be nitrate, or my colleague Professor LePere has been looking at viruses in groundwater. You don't want viruses that are going to make you sick in your drinking water source. And another issue here has to do with declining levels of groundwater in various areas. So what we do a lot in the state is we pump up groundwater, we use it for drinking water, and then we put it into the sewer system, which then puts it into a river. Right? And so we're not closing the loop on those issues there. If we look at a bigger picture across broader watersheds in the state of Minnesota, right, we have animal feeding operations where there's going to be manure management issues, and there's going to be bacteria that we want to have issues with getting into the water, but also these contaminants of emerging concern based on what's fed to the animals during their life cycle. Erosion has a lot to do with land use, right? And the more how we change the land use, the particles can come off the land, and this might be enhanced, again, due to climate change and changing in precipitation patterns. Mining, it gets a lot of attention in the state, right? So we have potential leaching of metals from tailings piles. We have potential for sulfide release that can affect wild rice. All of these are still issues that need to be dealt with. The effect of urbanization, right, is going to change how water flows. It's going to change how we manage stormwater and how much stormwater we produce. Stormwater control is done widely differently depending on where you are. You know, sometimes it's just channel into get it off the land as fast as possible and into the river, and that's done in both urban and agricultural environments. Sometimes it's infiltrated. There's positives and negatives of both of those in terms of infrastructure protection and water quality and water quantity. And again, underlying all this is climate change. And lastly, I'll stray into the controversial, since I know this particular crop has been discussed around the legislature in St. Paul at this point. So if changes in what's legal and what's not are made, or you have new policies or new products that come onto the market, that's going to change how water is used and impacted, right? So does this crop take more water or less water than what was grown there before? Is it grown indoors or is it grown outdoors? What chemicals and nutrients are applied to grow this crop? And this is a compound that's biologically active, right? We know that if you smoke cigarettes, you take in nicotine. If we look in wastewater treatment plants, we see nicotine. This crop has THC in it. Is it going to go into the wastewater treatment plants and make THC? Now, we could probably figure out usage now, right, and certainly being used now by some fraction of the population. But this would be a new source of chemicals and a new change in water in the environment that probably isn't thought about when thinking about legalizing this particular compound. So we have pressures on water quantity and quality in Minnesota, even though we are blessed to have sufficient water quality. But change is going to come at some point, and it's going to be gradual or it's going to be disruptive. And if we plan well, we can get rid of some of that disruptive change. So if we keep kind of going as we are, right, we're going to stress our sustainable water quantity and our water quality, right? And those things are needed for human well-being, for environment, for productive agriculture. We need good water quality. The industries in Minnesota need high quality water as well, right? Whether you're General Mills or your Ecolab or your 3M, quality water is important there as well. And impacts of climate change are going to be ameliorated in all of this. And so we're going to need innovation on the waterfront. So this might be in how we monitor viruses and bacteria and how we treat them for removal. Industry will have to help on this as well in terms of chemical design and marketing and regulation. Improved treatment technologies, right? We could add ozone to all of our wastewater treatment plants to get rid of contaminants of emerging concern. That will be expensive and energy intensive. how we manage water is going to be important, right? We're going to go down the – we already do reuse in Minnesota, right? The wastewater in St. Cloud goes into the river. We take it out of the river and we drink it in Minneapolis, right? How are we going to do those strategies as population grows and we're closer together and there's more wastewater capacity, or water flows have a larger fraction of wastewater? If we recharge groundwater with wastewater, what's that going to do in terms of reuse? And one of the big water issues is infrastructure rehabilitation and upgrades, right? There's lots of things we do with water that might not be the smartest use. So if you water your lawn, you're using high quality treated drinking water, right? And that's the way the system was built, and it's going to be hard to change that. But there's going to have to be some investment made in those areas. So with that, I would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Questions? I'll start over on this side first. I'll start with Representative Sundin. I'll work my way around.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you mentioned some of the sources of contamination, and I'm just very interested in the one contaminant you mentioned, tires. You know, they're up and down every highway and wearing out and going into the our water systems all over the state. And I know that there's such a thing as tire-derived aggregate now, that where they chop up the tires and put them in road beds or use them for round foundations for drainage, that type of thing. And it just always baffled me. Here's a product that, or a waste product, a tire, that is not allowed in many landfills, and we're spreading it all over the state in the roads and foundations, that type of thing. Has there been any research specific to car tires as far as a contaminant?
Mr. Arnold, Dr. Arnold?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sundin, members of the committee, the answer is yes. I am not abundantly familiar with it, but there is a wide variety of chemicals in tires. So tires, there's zinc in tires, there's something called benzotriazoles in tires. And if you chop them up, you put out in the environment, they're going to leach out over time. They're potential precursors for nitrosamines as well in tires. And so I always think of this as kind of, there was all the pressure-treated lumber, right, that people wanted to then chop up and use as mulch, right? That not a good idea, right? Right. When I was a kid, tire part, you know, there was tires, chopped up tires on the playgrounds, right? How we reuse these things takes some thought, and there are consequences of those. And I am not an expert in tire recycling or reuse, but I would expect there would be some impact.
Representative Sundin, any other questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, but I think that's something that this committee could be looking into during the course of this biennium.
I'm not advocating getting rid of tires either. So.
Thank you. Next, Representative Sandel.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Arnold, thanks very much for your time and the fascinating presentation this afternoon. This summer, Representative Claflin and I attended a couple of meetings put on by the Department of Public Health and the Pollution Control Agency regarding the 3M settlement in the Southeast Metro area. And the people around the table asked a couple of questions in one way or another over and over. How will we know when our water is safe and when? And will we be able to protect our water source in the future from some similar contamination? And based on your testimony this afternoon, my response is very pessimistic. Now, I want to be able to be optimistic, but it looks like a difficult future ahead of us. How do we face a future like this with continued increased pressure on our water source?
Dr. Arnold.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandel, members of the committee, I don't want you to be depressed. Our drinking water treatment plants do a really good job of providing safe water. So I think in terms of human consumption, you know, what I drink out of the tap, I'm perfectly comfortable with. There are always going to be chemicals we're exposed to, and we expose ourselves to them all the time. It's not just through our water, it's through our food and through our environment. And so there's always going to be some there. That's a sacrifice we make for modern life, right? And there are regulations for chemicals, for what they can be in our water. And there's going to be this trade-off that there's going to be some of them there, right? And, you know, at the EPA, that level of risk is 1 in 1,000,000, right? We allow 1 in 1,000,000 cancers to occur because we're willing to accept that level of risk. How are we going to – so there are always going to be chemicals in your water. So something like perfluorochemicals, right, we can use activated carbon to take it out. It's expensive, and it has to be replaced fairly often because it turns out these don't stick to carbon very well, but that's what's used in various drinking water plants. Professor Simsek and I in public health have been looking at other ways to actually sequester perfluorochemicals. There's some ways to destroy it. There's going to be a balance here, and we want cases. I think I'd rather have transparency and know what's there versus the case like in North Carolina where for 40 years they were drinking water with perfluorochemicals in it and they didn't know it. It's never going to be zero, but we're relying on regulators and toxicologists to tell us what's safe and what's acceptable. And there's always, you know, trying to a little bit of catch up because new chemicals come to market faster than we can test them. And when you there is testing that's done before chemicals come to market and they go into the environment, but there are things that happen that aren't expected, right? And so that takes time to figure that out. And hopefully, as we gather more and more knowledge, we can look at, like, one of my jobs is to look at chemical structures and say, this is a bad idea to bring this chemical to market. The question is, I need to be asked that question by the right people sometimes. But we're getting, I think, industry's getting better at that, and the communication has gotten better back and forth. I'm not sure I've totally settled your, or satisfied you, but.
Representative Sandel.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Arnold, would you say that the future of protecting our water is kind of a relationship between the state and private business as well, or can you answer a question like that by now?
Dr. Arnold?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandel, members of the committee, absolutely. I think there's going to be more and more communication back and forth, and I think a lot of companies and a lot of those in the Twin Cities, I've talked with people in 3M and Pentair, and like that, they want to be good environmental citizens. There's always going to be some company out there that puts profit over everything else, and hopefully they don't stay in business very long. But I think that's the exception rather than the rule. But there's going to be this communication between government, regulators, policymakers, academia, and industry that's going to have to occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr.
Dendel. Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Arnold, for being with us. Seems like every biennium we have a hot topic, and one of the hot topics this year has been the situation with True Shrimp. Getting their permits to conduct business in Minnesota, and one of the hang-ups in the permit was conductivity, a standard that I really was not aware of. Apparently, it's been around for a long time. Do you have any background knowledge on this particular standard and how it affects us here in Minnesota?
Dr. Arnold?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, members of the committee, I'll say yes and no. So we measure conductivity all the time in my lab when we're taking field samples. Basically, it's telling you the level of salt that's in the water, right? And so we did a study, and it can be, I'm going to use the word misleading here, but don't take it quite that way. It can be a misleading parameter in some ways. So this was about 10 years ago. We were doing a study in Minnehaha Creek, and whenever it rained, the conductivity went down. And which, okay, there's more water coming in, right? Conductivity goes down. But if we didn't measure the chloride and looked at the total amount of chloride that was there, the total amount of chloride went way up, right? And so there was a lot more chloride passing any particular point, just the concentration went down because there was a lot more water coming in. And so there's this trade-off in loads versus concentrations, and conductivity is really measuring the concentration. And depending on where it winds up eventually, it might matter. It might be the load that matters in the total amount of material or the concentration at a specific time point. And so any process that puts salt in the water is going to raise, and salt, not like sodium chloride, road salt, but calcium, sulfates, anything that's ionic that's in the water is going to raise the conductivity in some way. And I don't know, I know there are regulations for what conductivity should be. I don't know what they are off the top of my head or how they were arrived at. And I know, obviously, for some situations, if the conductivity gets too high and the water's too salty, then our freshwater fish don't survive anymore.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Arnold. I would hope that we would perhaps explore this particular standard in more depth at some future hearing.
Okay. Thank you for the suggestion. Appreciate that, Representative Torkelson. Any other questions for Dr. Arnold? Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Arnold. It was a great presentation. And next we will be hearing from Dr. Alexander.
Dr. Alexander, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and start your presentation, I would appreciate it.
Good afternoon. My name is Calvin Alexander. I am emeritus professor in the Earth Sciences Department at the University of Minnesota. It's been my great privilege to work and study groundwater in Minnesota since the late 1970s, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and I will try to answer your questions. I'm going to focus particularly on the southeastern portion of Minnesota. I want to, first of all, agree with my colleague. I really appreciated his overview of those. I want to build on one of his slides that has to do with the relationship between groundwater and surface waters. In our regulations and our rules, we treat them as though they were two different things. We have some surface water rules. We have groundwater rules. There's kind of the idea that they're two different things. They are intimately related. Surface water, rain falls out of the sky. If it runs off its surface water, if it sinks into its groundwater, that groundwater on an enormous range of timescales from very short to very long comes back to the surface in springs and wells and feeds the base flows in the river. So these are two intimately connected things. I want to build on this one slide. I give up. I'm seeing it, but you're not seeing it.
Uh-oh.
You got it there? Aha. Okay. This is a classic picture of how groundwater moves from precipitation through the surface and then comes back out into streams. This is an incredibly simplified view. This may actually pertain to some places in some small parts of Minnesota, but it doesn't describe how it works in most places. Groundwater flow in Minnesota karstlands in particular is much more complex, much more rapid than the current conceptual and mathematical models imply. We build rules based on these very simple concepts, on these very simple mathematical models, and they simply don't adequately describe what's going on. So Minnesota karstlands, what are we talking about? Karst is a kind of landscape, it's a kind of aquifer that forms where the rocks are soluble, that they dissolve in the groundwater that's moving through them. So this first map is the one that we put together coming up on 20 years ago now, showing the areas in underlain in Minnesota, the areas in Minnesota that are underlain by soluble rocks, by limestone and dolomites and sandstones. Part of this area is covered by more recent glacial deposits. These are all Paleozoic rocks. They're 400 million years old, more or less. So in this map, which is an old map now, but it shows that the active karst areas are the areas where those rocks are covered by less than 50 feet of glacial sediments. On the western portion of this, the glaciers have 12,000 years ago have covered this up with hundreds of feet of sediments. The aquifers are still there. They still are karst aquifers, but they are covered by more recent sediments. If you want a give up. There we go. Get that one? Yes. This is a more recent map that just focuses on this active karst area. It's the red areas are the same, but it also points out that it's not just in the southeastern portion, including the metro area, by the way. Notice that the area shown on these maps includes the metro area, but there's also areas up in Pine County where you have sinkholes and karst features and the same sorts of problems. So this is a more widespread problem than we typically realize. Again, compare that back to this to that little model that we started with. This is a much better cartoon of what the landscape looks like in southeastern Minnesota. It's not solid bedrock. It's bedrock that's full of holes and caves and fractures and crevices, and the groundwater moves very rapidly through it. In many places, it sinks through the surface. There are discrete places where whole rivers disappear underground. But throughout the farm fields, throughout all of the things that people do, the water penetrates very rapidly. The time scales is often minutes between the time that the rain falls on the surface and then it can be coming out someone's well. It's rarely more than days or weeks. This is the surface part of it. In the deeper parts of it, the time scales can get very long, thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of years. Okay. These are that simple picture that we started out was making the assumption that there was a single type of porosity and permeability that the rocks, that the water was moving through in the rocks or in the soils, and that can be described by very simple mathematical expressions. Actually, the real aquifers have three kinds of porosity and permeability in the same volume of rock. There is a matrix there. This is the fine grain holes. This is where most of the water spends most of its time. In that same volume of rock, there are also fractures and bedding planes. These are open crevices that the water can move more rapidly through. And finally, those connecting up those fractures are conduits or channels. Most of the water in the aquifer is in the matrix most of the time. It then moves into the fractures, and when it's trying to move long distance in conduits, it moves very rapidly. So in the conduits, you may have flow velocities that are measured in miles per day, and we routinely put, for example, dyes or ag chemicals inadvertently into these surfaces, and they will show up in springs on a time scale of a day or less that are miles away. They move very rapidly. Let me just try to give you a picture, a real picture of what's going on. This is an old quarry down in Fillmore County, and you can see the ones labeled one are the kinds of conduits. There's a big open fracture through that limestone. This is almost big enough that a person can get into. Any water that falls on the surface of that can flow straight down through that crack and crevice very, very rapidly. There's also a major horizontal conduit there that has, where the rock has dissolved along a bedding plane. You can see the little fractures up near the top that are labeled two, the vertical and horizontal. And finally, the matrix is in the rock itself. So again, most of the water is in the matrix most of the time. Most of the movement of water from one place to another is via these fractures and then ultimately the conduits. The next five slides, I want to get an advertisement here for my colleagues at the Minnesota Geological Survey. These are used directly or modified from the work that they've been doing for many, many years. These are the people who have helped fundamentally change how we view our aquifers in southeastern Minnesota. The first of these is what I think is a better way of looking at the aquifers. This is the kind of rocks that are beneath our feet right now, right where we're standing right now. And there's not an aquifer. There are 12 or 14 or 15 aquifers under us, separated by rocks that slow down but don't stop the movement of water between them. So the blue rocks in here are the ones that contain and yield water. The brown rocks are the ones that slow down the movement. They also have water in them. It just doesn't move very fast. And all of the little black lines that you can just barely see are the fractures and the conduits. These are mappable units now by the Geological Forum. The fracture and conduit flow dominate the long-scale movement of water. These are the sort of things that moves PFCs from a 3M dump to the southern part of Washington County on a time scale of a few tens of years. These are the super highways that let the water move very rapidly. There is a very rapid recharge. There are no lakes to talk about in southeastern Minnesota, simply because the water doesn't stay on the surface. It goes into the subsurface very rapidly. The only lakes are temporary ones where they've dammed up one of the base flow rivers, and they typically silt up on a human time scale. There's a whole stack of aquifers and aquitards. There's very rapid flow through the horizontal fractures, and there's slower downward recharge to the deeper aquifers. One of the things that I and my colleagues have been doing for many years is determining how long that groundwater has been in the ground. And the answer ranges from a few hours to hundreds of thousands of years. And the deeper aquifers, the ones with the long residence time, are water that went in the ground long before human beings were doing things on the surfaces. That is a non-renewable resource. When you pump it out, it's gone. You make it recent recharge. And when you pump it out of the deeper aquifers, that means there's going to be more recharge from the shallow aquifers, and the shallow aquifers are the ones that have most of the pollutants in them. Overall, the flow is toward the Mississippi River, which is the drain that takes all the water down and with all of our additives to it and dumps it in the river. Okay, I want to talk particularly about nitrate concentration, because this is the major portion in southeastern Minnesota, or the major problem in southeastern Minnesota. This is just because that's what that farming is the major occupation, and that's what covers most of the landscape. There is a big problem, and this little map in the upper right-hand corner of this shows the green dots are all wells that have elevated nitrate levels in them. It's a little harder to see in the lower diagram, but they're color-coded here. The green near-surface waters are the waters that have high nitrates in them. The water's in the deeper for aquifers. The nitrate hasn't yet gotten to it, but it's on its way. Not only is it nitrates, it's herbicides, it's pesticides, it's bacteria, viruses, anything that are in the water that is infiltrating through the surface. Many of these upper aquifers, the shallow aquifers, now contain nitrate levels in the 10 or 15 parts per million range at or above the drinking water standard. There are wells that have two or three times the drinking water standard of there. What we have as a society has done is just stopped using these aquifers. We don't allow shallow wells to be drilled anymore in these. We have to case and grout through these and use the deeper aquifers. Those deeper aquifers still have old, relatively clean water in it, but as we pump that out, it gets recharged from the shallow, and so that you have these fronts of nitrates moving through. This is a diagram that was put together by some of my colleagues in the Pollution Control Agency down in Rochester. They did a very simple thing. They went out and simply looked at the water levels, the nitrate contents in springs, and they did a GIS exercise to look at how much row crop there was in the watershed that fed that particular spring. Now, most of the streams in southeastern Minnesota are fed by groundwater. There's not surface runoff except after the biggest rainfalls. Most of the base flow is just simply spring water that has come back into them. And what they found was this very nice relationship. This is a plot of the nitrate levels in the springs or in the streams versus the percent of row crop agriculture. And you see a nice straight line relationship there. And notice that line goes through zero. If there weren't row crop agriculture in these and feedlots in these farmsteads, there wouldn't be any nitrates there. When you get to about half of the landscape covered by row crop agriculture and feedlots, you're above the 10 parts per million drinking water standard. Now, there's some interesting things here, because there are low points and there are high points. And it turns out that the high points are in the shallow aquifers, and the low points are streams that are being fed by springs coming out of the lower aquifers. We've got that same diagram I was showing you before, but now we are color-coding them on the residence time of the water. And what you see here is the reds are aquifers that contain water that has been recharged in the last few decades. The blue are the waters that have been recharged for hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago. And the green are the mixtures of the two that are in between. And so these low points in this diagram are springs that are coming out deeper into the section which are being fed by water that has been in the ground for a long time. The higher points are the ones that are from the shallow aquifers. So one of the questions that you're faced with is you get apparently contradictory evidence. People say, my well's contaminated. Somebody says, well, my well's not. You know, what are you doing wrong or what's happening? What's the difference here? You're looking at two different kinds of water that are coming out of these. If you look at the wells and the springs that are coming from deep in the aquifer, this is the green point called Peterson Spring, and it's the upper diagram. What you see is a steady increase of nitrates, but they're not that high yet. Notice the numbers on the vertical scale are 3 to 4. If you look at a spring like the Red Spring, Fountain West Spring, you see numbers that are much higher, and they're just bouncing up and down, and maybe they're going up, maybe they're going down, but the numbers here are 10 to 15 parts per million versus 4 parts per million. So the solution up until now has been to dig a deeper well, and that is just building more problems into you in the future. The better solution, the one that worked for our rivers in the 70s, 80s, is stop dumping things into them. Okay? It's not that easy in this case. Let me just show you some interesting data we have on the lags. Again, using this same diagram where the red water is the young water and the blue water is the older water, we have a really good example of this. This is a place called Stonehenge. If some of you are familiar with Rochester, this is, I'm sorry, Stonehedge. This is on the eastern side of Rochester. This was a farm field up until about 2000. And in 2 years, in 2000, they converted this, what used to be a farm field, into a housing development. Hooking up to the sewers and converting into lawns from and houses and streets from corn and soybeans. There was a monitoring well there that's been monitored ever since. It started out with nitrate levels about 2 times the drinking water standard, up around 20. And over the intervening years, it has dropped down to now it's down to about 3 or 4. So when you stop putting the excess nitrogen on the farm fields, the water cleans itself up. That's encouraging. That's positive. And the time lag, it started cleaning itself up in about 2 years after we stopped putting the levels of nitrate on it. Here are two other graphs from other wells in Rochester. This is one of the deep municipal wells. And what's showing here in the green on the left is the diagram that shows the nitrates in that deep well, and it was non-detectable up until about 2000, and it has now risen up to where it's about 4 or 5, about half of the drinking water standard. The black dots are the usage of nitrate fertilizers that really took off in the 1960s. So what you're seeing is a time lag here. It took about 40 years for the extra nitrates that we were putting on these fields to suddenly get to work its way down into this deep aquifer. The second diagram on the right is a similar thing. This is the black dots in this case are the SO2 that we used to throw up into the atmosphere from coal-burning power plants. This was the acid rain that we had in the 70s and 80s. As a society, we put scrubbers on them. We invested a whole lot of money, and it's dropped down to very low numbers now. And when you look at the sulfates from that in this same well, again, you see about a 40-year lag. So there's two big signals that have gone into the system, and it took about 40 years to get this deep aquifer, whereas in the very shallow aquifer, the time scales is much shorter. The shallow ground and surface waters in Minnesota karst lands are highly susceptible to contamination from human activities on land surface. It depends entirely on what people are doing. If you are in the metro area, the problem is industrial and urban pollution. If you are in an agricultural area, which is what most of the area that I'm talking about is, the main source is agriculture. The shallow aquifers get contaminated on very short time scales, minutes to days. The deeper aquifers recharge on longer time scales, and increased pumping increases the rate at which this pollution moves into the deeper aquifers. Many of the models and rules and regulations based on the conceptual and computer models do not adequately describe the rapid and highly variable movement of the surface and groundwaters in the karst region. Thank you. I will try to answer some questions.
Thank you, Dr. Alexander. That was a very, very informative presentation. I'll open up to questions. Yeah, I see a few people just kind of going, it's a lot coming at them. Does anyone have any particular questions for Dr. Alexander? I will toss out one is I noticed you close saying that many of the models and rules aren't able to graph the way things are moving in the karst region. So how do we address the issue going forward? Is development is going to continue to happen in the area? Agriculture is going to, farms are going to, factory farms where you've got a lot of livestock together are going to continue to happen in the area. How can you actually predict what might be happening in that area if the models aren't going to be helpful? Dr. Alexander.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I would throw the question right back at you. I'm an American. I believe in democracy. I believe in legislatures. I, as an individual citizen, will help elect some of you to deal with these problems. I, as a university professor and a scientist, try to convey as best I can the knowledge, and as my colleague has pointed out, change is happening. New things are coming in and so forth. Again, I'm talking about agriculture just because that's what's going on where I am. One of the challenges that we have is that my colleagues on the St. Paul campus have did an enormous amount of work in the decades trying to improve the way in which nitrate is picked up by the, I mean, it's a necessary nutrient. It increases yield. It's something that you have to have. And what they have found very generally is that you want to put the nitrate on just when the plants need it. Nitrates are also very soluble, and so if they're sitting there for weeks or months before the plants need them, they will either wash off the surface or surface in. So one of the thrusts has been to put just the right amount and put it on in two or three things in the late spring and maybe even after the crops are getting up. When you start talking about these large animal feedlots, what they're doing is they're collecting the manure and they're going to spread it on the fields, but the only time you can't put it on frozen ground and you can't put it in the when the land is covered by corn and soybeans, so you've got this little window in the spring and this little window in the fall that you can, and usually it's the little window in the fall, because in the spring what you want to do first and foremost is to get the plants planted. In Minnesota you don't have a very long growing season, and a couple of weeks in the spring can blow your crop in the fall. So you're putting it all on in the fall, letting it sit there all year, and then it's not going at the right thing. Somehow we're hoping that this knowledge can get built in. Member Sandell asked about, he's not very optimistic about some of the problems that you were going on. I am. One of the things that gray hair brings to you is we're doing things a whole lot better than we did when I started in 1974. We have made progress. We've got a long way to go. But you people are asking the right questions, and you have the wisdom to put it into rules and regulations and the tools.
that will build this into doing a better job of it. Just one anecdotal thing, something that I'm proud of. If you drive around southeastern Minnesota and Fillmore County and the other counties, you'll see a lot of sinkholes. And if you look carefully, you'll still see a whole lot of junk in them. People used to, you know, threw things in them. Dead animals, pesticide cans, unbelievable things. If you look carefully, though, now, you don't see new junk. What you see is old junk. The people who live there, work there, and play there just don't do it anymore. Because a lot of people have spent a lot of time convincing people that the soundbite that stuck is very simple. Don't put anything in a sinkhole you don't want to drink. And that's a message that has changed behavior for the better. And my colleagues and I are working on all kinds of different ways. We just have to get people to understand that the drinking water is an important resource.
Thank you, Dr. Alexander. That was encouraging. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Alexander, for being here, and thank you especially for those last few remarks. I think they did clarify things quite a bit. The other thing I think we need to be very careful of is not generalizing about the entire state when it comes to what happens in southeast Minnesota, because the southeastern part of the state is dramatically different geologically than the rest of Minnesota. And while we do share some similar issues, the way these elements react on the landscape is much different in the karst topography.
And sir, I completely agree with you. I just spent the last couple of weeks working up north of Ely on some wells there. That's not karst at all. It's fractured bedrock, and it doesn't look anything like that little diagram that we started out with. If you're up in the northwestern corner of the state in the Lake Agassiz Plain, you've got a deep, thick layer of lake clay there. It's completely different from southeast, from northeast. If you're out in the southwestern part of the state, it's getting kind of dry out there, and there really isn't much good aquifers there, and so they're still trying to figure out ways to import the Missouri River over and so forth. But yes, it is not a single thing. It is a whole bunch of things. That means the right rules and regulations for southeastern Minnesota might not make any sense at all, and northeastern might not make any sense in northwestern. And you've seen a couple of maps. My colleagues in the state agencies are mapping out the different districts, the people at the surveyor district. This is not an unknown thing. It's just one size doesn't fit all.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alexander. I appreciate it. We've hit the end of our time for today, so I will declare us meeting adjourned and remind everyone that we'll be meeting weekly from today. Thank you.